This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you once again on this Saturday morning, where we're going to talk about some health stories that have come up in the news and also chat with a guest. And in fact, our guest today is going to be Dr. Evan Nadler. Dr. Nadler specializes in internal medicine and pulmonary diseases at Trinity Health of New England. And he's here to talk about an exciting program that they have there that will deal with the problem of pulmonary emboli. So for many people, when you hear the word pulmonary emboli, you understand that this is a critical problem and life-threatening problem. So he's going to be on to chat with us later on a little bit about this exciting program. You know, during the week, I hear things that I think are just going to be interesting for all of us. And this week, a lot of what I was hearing about had to do with brain health and getting us to think a little bit more clearly. I was watching a show about Steve Martin. It was a documentary on one of the streaming services. And it was interesting because he's 75 years old now. And he, like many of us, have found this transition in our careers to be somewhat of an awakening. And he talks a little bit about a word that he learned in Hungarian called piantagu. Piantagu is a word that means with a relaxed brain being quick-witted and sharp. It's very interesting because he said that at age 75, he finds that since he's not under a lot of pressure, such as, in his case, coming up with a joke by a deadline or a new title or something, he's able to think more clearly and come up with better material, as he has with his friend Martin Short. At this older age where pressure is off. And I think a lot of us have experienced this when we're on vacation. We don't have a schedule to stick to, and things are a lot more relaxed. You're able to approach a problem or a situation much more clearly. So it was interesting that the Hungarian people have a word for this. And I think that also raises the issue of retirement, or whatever that is. You would think that someone at the age of 75 should be retired. But retirement really has been redefined recently, I think, as maybe the baby boomer generation, as we've become older, and really redefined as a time to stop and start thinking more creatively. And it doesn't have to be about work. I mean, people suddenly take up cooking and start thinking about different ways of cooking or writing or even inventing. I've had several patients who have become successful inventors after working their entire careers at another job where they didn't have time to sit and create. So I thought I'd share that with you. Another thing that comes up, and it was about hoarding, and read an article about that, and really the connection between mental health and housekeeping, and the fact that if you're working in a really messy environment, it results in extra stress and a feeling of being overwhelmed. So that, again, your environment, which may not be orderly, can, in many cases, really impede your ability to think creatively. And they suggest that to correct this, to really just start small. Don't think, okay, I've got to tackle this big job. especially if it comes to as many people are collecting things, right? And as you get older, you find out that the only thing that's worth your collection is the fact that your children are going to pull up a dumpster. So you may want to start going through things and getting rid of those and start small. And you'll find, again, that that may help you think more creatively. Another thing that helps in many respects is power naps. Now, it's something I became accustomed to when I went to medical school in Italy. As many of you know from European travel, things shut down at noontime, at lunchtime. And the issue here is how long should you take a, quote, power nap for? So recent studies have looked at this and found that it really should be no longer than 20 to 30 minutes. So, for example, when you look at what are the benefits of it, again, increased, improved creativity, your mood, your energy level, and heart health. Now, it's not a situation where some is good and more is better, because they found that napping for more than 45 minutes can have a deleterious effect on heart problems. So they recommended in this article, if you're going to take a nap, it really should be in the early afternoon, so it doesn't impact your sleep at night, and to set an alarm for 30 minutes. It's also interesting that part of this topic comes up every morning. I get a question to answer for CME. So as a physician, you're required to do continuing medical education. And in neurology, they have a thing called the question of the day. And the question of the day today had to deal with people presenting with mild cognitive impairment and what might be a common cause of people having trouble thinking clearly, some short-term memory things, becoming forgetful. And one of them was poor sleep at night. Because as we get older, it becomes more difficult to maintain a good sleep schedule. And that can impact your ability to think clearly. So when you become somewhat forgetful, it doesn't mean you have dementia, but you should really see a doctor and look at all the different factors that might be impacting that. This day in medicine, May 11th, 1684, Dr. Daniel Whistler died. Dr. Whistler was an English physician who gave one of the earliest descriptions of rickets. Now, for those of you who don't remember, rickets is a softening of bones due to prolonged vitamin D deficiency. You often see this in children. And as we know from our discussions and our interview with Dr. Mirza several weeks ago, vitamin D helps us absorb calcium and phosphorus to form bones. So it really applies to that discussion we had regarding osteoporosis. So again, from May 11th in 1684 is when Dr. Daniel Whistler dies, and we remember that today. So we're going to take a short break, and I'm open to questions. If you have questions regarding pulmonary disease, any type of lung problem, and especially about pulmonary emboli, get them over to me at info@alessimd.com. We're going to be back shortly with my guest today, Dr. Evan Nadler, and we're going to be talking about pulmonary emboli. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you this morning. And to welcome my guest, Dr. Evan Nadler. Dr. Nadler is a medical doctor specializing in pulmonary diseases and critical care at Trinity Health of New England, and specifically St. Francis Hospital. Dr. Nadler, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start by talking a little bit about your background. How did you get into the study of pulmonary diseases?
Yeah, so my background is actually a little bit different than the norm, but I'm from Canada, and I went to McGill University and started off in business. And throughout the course of my undergraduate studies, I took a few science classes and tended to veer towards that. And I ended up staying in university for a couple more years studying science. And then I went to American University of the Caribbean for medical school. Through there, I came to the University of Connecticut for residency. And I initially wanted to be a hematologist oncologist, which ended up being a part of why I'm interested in pulmonary embolisms. But from the time I started residency, we did a lot of rotations in critical care units. And that's where my initial passion for pulmonary critical care developed. And then I did a lot of rotations in pulmonary medicine and realized how diverse it was and how much of an impact you can have on people's ability to live and breathe. So I did a chief residency year at St. Francis after residency, and then I started my pulmonary critical care fellowship at University of Connecticut, which was another 3 years of training in both specialties.
What encompasses the field of pulmonary critical care? It sounds pretty descriptive, but I think there's a lot more to it. Can you explain that to our audience?
Yeah, so it's basically two completely different specialties. The critical care aspect is mostly working in the intensive care unit in the hospital, which is taking care of patients who have various medical diseases, commonly respiratory failure or infections that lead to sepsis, which is a systemic inflammatory response to an infection. And a lot of these patients require mechanical ventilators and management of that, which is part of the pulmonary aspect of things, and also management of their blood pressure being low and trying to support them through their illness. Then the pulmonary aspect is in the office and also in the hospital doing consults on patients with respiratory diseases. So the large focus there is mostly in the office-based practice with common diseases such as COPD and asthma, but a lot of other diseases that are less commonly well-known, like interstitial lung diseases, and for me, pulmonary embolisms.
Let's talk a little bit about the pulmonary system, just to bring everybody up to speed. Can you give us the brief overview of the pulmonary system and how it interacts with our bodies?
Yes, so there's two separate parts of it. In the most basic form, we take in a breath of air, which has a combination of different gases, but particularly oxygen, and we breathe that in through our respiratory tract, and that interacts with the bloodstream that is bringing blood back from the rest of our body after it's used oxygen, which is deoxygenated blood, and the interaction between the two, the blood is then oxygenated before it goes out to the left side of the heart and the rest of the body. And we also, from that same method, breathe out carbon dioxide.
When we talk about things like smoking or other illnesses that affect the lungs, can you talk a little bit about how that affects lung? We know that it causes cancer, but there are obviously other deleterious effects for smoking and being around smoke and inhaling anything that's toxic.
That's a great question. It can be quite complex, but there's one of the basic things that happens with smoking is the impairment of there's little hairs that line the respiratory tract, and those become kind of injured and don't work as well, and it becomes difficult to get bacteria and other bad things out of your lungs, but also causes direct damage to the lung tissue and elasticity, which can lead to things like chronic bronchitis and emphysema. There's another host of diseases that affects more the lung tissue related to smoking, which can be a form of interstitial lung disease. So there's a lot of different damaging effects of smoking that can affect the airways and the lung tissue itself.
Let's take a step back and get right into it from the standpoint of pulmonary emboli. What are pulmonary emboli?
So a pulmonary emboli is a blood clot that ends up getting stuck in the pulmonary vasculature or the pulmonary arteries. And the pulmonary arteries are coming off of the right side of the heart, which take all of the blood back from the veins in your body. So these commonly start as blood clots in your lower extremities, so which is called a deep vein thrombosis. Less commonly in the arms or other areas in the body, But basically what happens is they develop in the legs, and once they are large enough or high enough up in your legs, they break off. And that travels up through the veins in your body up to the right side of the heart. And from there, it gets pushed into the pulmonary arteries, and they get stuck in that location. So it's not actually in your lung tissue. It's in the arteries of the lungs.
Well, obviously, it can result in death. But how often, first of all, how often do we see pulmonary emboli affecting the population? How common a problem is it?
So it's actually very common, probably not talked about as much as some other common diseases, but it's actually the third most common cause of cardiovascular death after a myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, and stroke. So it's actually very common. It's one of the most common things we see in the hospital, and it's quite heterogeneous as well. It can be very mild, or it can be life-threatening.
We're going to take a we got a minute left before we take a break, and we talked about it being life-threatening. From the standpoint of it being life-threatening, is it because it is blocking that one artery, or does it shower and affect multiple arteries?
It actually can be both of those, depending on the location and size. When you have a large enough amount of blood clot that's blocking the arteries, particularly in the main central artery, you can have hemodynamic issues because the right ventricle becomes enlarged and doesn't like to pump as easily. And it's kind of like a plumbing system that gets backed up. All of the blood goes backwards, and you end up having issues with maintaining your blood pressure. And it's a cause of cardiogenic shock, basically. The other aspect is if you have a lot of smaller blood clots that are on both sides, more out further in the lungs, you can have more issues with oxygenation and have really low oxygen levels that can also become life-threatening.
This is fascinating stuff. And I already have a question here from Bob about deep vein thromboses. That, Bob, I'm going to get to your question as soon as we get back. We're going to take a short break. And if you have questions for Dr. Nadler, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. As I said, we're going to take a short break. Then we'll be back to talk more about pulmonary emboli and really what we could do to avoid pulmonary emboli and an exciting new program to treat this life-threatening condition. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is Dr. Evan Nadler. Dr. Nadler is a medical doctor, and he is a specialist in pulmonary diseases and critical care at St. Francis Hospital. If you wish to reach Dr. Nadler and make an appointment with his office, the phone number is 860-714-4055. Dr. Nadler, we have actually two questions came in, and both have to do with the same topic, and dealing with deep vein thromboses. So it seems like you hit on an interesting issue right there. One question is from Margaret. And she's been hearing about microclotting, and people use a description of dirty blood and the use of a D-dimer test to identify these tiny clots that are not usually visible to imaging tests. The other question is from Bob as to how do deep vein thromboses form? So I guess we're touching a little bit about your interest in hematology and oncology at the same time. You want to give it a go?
Yes. So the D-dimer test is a great kind of screening test, we call it, when we don't have a high pretest probability for a blood clot, meaning that we think it could be something else, but we want to make sure that that's not the case. However, you have to take into account the patient's age and their other risk factors, such as if they have other diseases that may elevate that level as well. Particularly in terms of the microclotting, which can't be picked up on an ultrasound, it's possible that the D-dimer test may not be possible. So that becomes very difficult then. And the best thing in that sense would be to monitor an ultrasound closely because if you do have very small blood clots that aren't able to be picked up on imaging, then it's possible that they could get larger over several days to weeks. So I'm not an expert in deep vein thrombosis, but my recommendation would be to monitor it closely and possibly see a vascular specialist.
And it's a blood test, correct?
Yes, it's just a blood test. There's a couple of different ways that it's tested and different numbers, but they are adjusted for age typically. There's a cutoff that we use, a specific calculator. But yes, it's just a blood test, and we use it frequently in trying to determine whether we should do further testing.
And kind of globally, what can you just explain to everybody what a deep vein thrombosis is?
Yes, so it's a formation of blood that's coagulated, which is a blood clot in the lower extremities, which can be in the calf, all the way up through to the hips. And what this, it can also be in the upper arms and various other veins in your body. And you develop these for different reasons. The classic teaching is a triad called Virchow's triad, which has three different things that can lead to elevated risk for blood clots, and that's stasis of blood, which is blood pooling, if you have a hypercoagulability, or if you have injury to your blood vessels. And there's a lot of different things that can lead to that risk. Some of the more common ones are like a fracture to your lower extremity or knee or hip surgery, cancer, if you had trauma, if you had catheters placed in your leg, immobility, and then lower risks that people talk about a lot but are actually not considered high provoking factors are things like prolonged travel by flight or car.
So when we look at that, are there other medical conditions? For example, obviously, I think it's obvious that you see more deep vein thrombosis in smokers, people who are obese. Are there other general characteristics that people might be able to correct in order to lower their risk for deep vein thrombosis?
So that's a good point. Those are probably the two most modifiable risk factors, obesity and smoking. Other diseases that have a high risk are heart failure and patients with atrial fibrillation, although a lot of patients with atrial fibrillation are already on blood thinners. So the biggest thing is being healthy in general and staying active. If you're overweight and smoking and immobile, the risk of developing various diseases is high, including deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary emboli.
I have another question from John, and his question is, there are a lot of different socks out on the market that they say prevent deep vein thrombosis. And I think, are they of any use? And I think you and I are most familiar with the kind that is so hard to put on, like when you get out of a hospital. But are there other socks that are on the general market that people can wear if they're on a long trip, air travel or something of that nature, that help? Or is it just a marketing deal?
No, that's a great question, too. There's a lot of companies that make socks that you wouldn't even know are compression stockings, and a lot of us actually wear them in the hospital. One of the cardiologists that's a part of my team and myself, we wear compression stockings, and I just buy them from a company called Pro Compression. And there's different patterns. They can have dress socks or more athletic socks. And we typically recommend wearing below the knee compression stockings. They can be hard to put on, but there's different sizes and different strengths as well. But we do recommend them as a preventative thing. And also once people have had deep vein thromboses, that they wear them in the daytime as much as possible. And when they're sleeping at night, it's not necessary to wear them.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, well, first of all, I don't think John could get a better endorsement than the fact that you wear them. But the point, I guess, is I always thought they were best if you were idle. Now, obviously, you're running around the hospital, but yet you still see the need to wear them. Why is that?
So My work, I'm on my feet, but also standing still, for example, when I'm rounding with my team, yeah. Or I'm sitting at my desk and sometimes crossing my legs. So there is a lot of times during the day where there's the chance that I have blood pooling and just less mobility. So this is what I do every day, and I see various people develop deep vein thrombosis. So it's one thing that I can do to help my blood flow throughout the day and try to just do anything else that can keep me healthy and keep the veins moving.
Do you advocate for people to work standing up? It's interesting because I've been seeing more and more people work at the so-called stand-up desk. Does that give you an advantage from the standpoint of blood pooling and DVTs, even if you're standing still as opposed to sitting for long periods of time?
Possibly, but I think in terms of standing, it's keeping moving a little bit. And it's the same as if you're sitting on an airplane for several hours, moving your legs and trying to avoid crossing your legs and doing various movements with your legs can be helpful. And it's the same if you're standing, not being in one spot for a long time would be a most benefit.
Well, let's get to what we can do about pulmonary emboli, and specifically about this program that you're involved in, the PERT program, Pulmonary Embolism Response Team. Can you talk a little bit about that, and not only that, but other things people can do to avoid pulmonary emboli and other treatments you have?
Yes, definitely. So the Pulmonary Embolism Response Team, or PERT, has been around for over 10 years now. And the way I see it is three different aspects to it. There's the acute management in the hospital, and then there's the follow-up in the office, which is what I do a lot of times in my pulmonary clinic. And then there's the research and education part of things. The whole reason that they were developed and I started the team at St. Francis is because of how complex the treatment modalities have become in managing pulmonary emboli. Since I started my training to now, things have changed drastically. The mainstay still remains anticoagulation or blood thinners. However, in patients who have a more high-risk disease, there's a lot more treatment options these days. And these are typically patients who have developed issues with their right ventricle related to the pulmonary emboli. And this is patients who are either already really sick and have low blood pressure, which could lead to death, or patients who are on the verge of becoming worse that we like to intervene on. So that kind of ties into why we have the team. So the actual team is like a rapid response team made up of various subspecialties. So every hospital that has a PERT may have a different group of people. Ours is predominantly pulmonology and critical care doctors, interventional cardiologists, hematologists, cardiothoracic surgeons, and interventional radiologists. So what happens is when a patient comes in with a suspected or diagnosed pulmonary embolism, the emergency room doctors or the doctors in the hospital call our team, and we come immediately to evaluate the patient. We take a history, we look at all of their vital signs, how much oxygen they're on, and we do a real-time ultrasound of their heart to immediately have an idea of how the right ventricle looks. And from there, we decide if we have to discuss this with the rest of the team. So when the whole purpose of this is to have a whole discussion with including the patient about what the options are and what we think the best treatment modality might be. So whether that's just blood thinners, or if they're really sick, sometimes we use a medicine that breaks up the blood clots, which can be given intravenously. The really, really sick patients, some of them need to be placed on a bypass machine called ECMO, or even have a surgical embolectomy where the blood clot is actually removed surgically. In between that, where there's a little more uncertainty is when they're somewhat stable, but their right side of their heart looks poor. And those patients, we consider some of the newer modalities, which include catheter-directed treatments. And this is basically a catheter that's placed into the vein in the groin region and the catheter goes up into the pulmonary arteries where we can deliver clot-busting medication or actually suck out the blood clots physically in real time. So these are the treatment decisions we're trying to discuss with our team in as soon as we can, because we don't like to delay making a decision when patients could be on the verge of deteriorating quickly. Well, so that's the main, yes.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the main inpatient treatment options. And then the decisions we make after in the office are more, you know, risk mitigation, what type of blood thinners we should use long term and how long to use them, and following the patients to make sure that they don't develop any chronic issues related to it.
And that's what I was going to get to is, all right, after the treatment, how many people have these recur? I mean, is it a single event or is it something now that becomes more commonplace?
That is the million-dollar question. And something else that's changed over the course of the last 10 years, probably, the patients who have a higher risk of recurrence are, one, patients who there's no real reason why they had the blood clot. They don't have a high provoking factor, such as a knee surgery or hip fracture. And those patients, we might do additional blood work to see if they have a genetic mutation that led to the blood clot. Or patients, for example, with cancer who are on chemotherapy, if we stop blood thinners in those patients, there's a high chance that they come back. In patients who we don't find any risk factors, the chance that they have a recurrent event is up to 30 to 40% after stopping blood thinners. So the favor has been to treat those type of patients a little bit longer term, sometimes indefinitely.
Wow. So so it's a pretty significant number of cases that recur. From one of the questions that came up, Pat had a question when you brought up the idea of anticoagulants and blood thinners. Are some better than others? Can you chat just a little bit about those, especially the new ones, the NOACs and that whole group?
Yes, definitely. So there's kind of two phases. One is the acute phase, which is in the hospital. We usually put people on injections in their stomach, or which is a low molecular weight heparin, or in the IV, an intravenous heparin. And those eventually would be changed over to a longer-term anticoagulant, which is by mouth. So the one that's been around for the longest is warfarin, and some of the newer ones are medications called rivaroxaban or apixaban, and there's several others, but those are the main ones that we use now. And there's a few different things we take into account when we choose which one we may use. The actual guidelines recommend using one of the newer agents over warfarin now. And the main issue with warfarin is that you have to get your blood levels checked, you have to watch your diet, and the levels can be low or high. The newer ones are a little bit more convenient. And really, we just monitor the kidney function every 6 months, monitor their blood counts, but they don't need monitoring frequently. So they're a little bit more convenient. The only times where we may not be able to use them are in patients with significant kidney disease and patients who are very overweight.
One of the things I want to get back to a little bit about the PERT program, because one of the things we've learned in critical care, especially in neurology, has been, you know, when someone has a stroke and they're brought to a stroke center, their chances of survival, and more important, not just surviving, but getting back to their usual level of activity, is much more increased by having a program in place. And I'm assuming that's the same with the PERT program. Do you have evidence? Is there enough data to show that now that if you're going to a hospital that's equipped with a multidisciplinary team, that your chances of surviving and getting back to your baseline are greater?
Yes, there actually is a lot of studies that have shown a couple of different things. So one is a reduction in mortality, particularly in the higher risk patients. And along with that is a shorter time in the hospital, shorter time in the intensive care unit, and access to all of these other treatment options, which ultimately allow the right side of your heart to improve quicker and get you back to feeling closer to baseline sometimes within days, other times within a couple of weeks. So there's been a lot of benefit of having access to these teams. And I think it's only going to continue to improve as these teams continue to expand. And I mean, even at our hospital, we've had, you know, newer doctors coming in to help with the team, and allowing us access to better treatment options. So we actually take referrals from other hospitals because they have come to see that we have these abilities that aren't as widespread as some of the other smaller hospitals.
Evan, what's the next big thing coming in pulmonary disease and pulmonary treatment, whether it be in general or with respect to the treatment of pulmonary emboli? What's something our audience really needs to know?
One of the big things is the further development of these catheter-directed treatment options. There's a lot of newer ones that are coming out to allow for different techniques that are less invasive and safer for patients. But I think the most interesting thing, and it has kind of started in the stroke world, is artificial intelligence. And in terms of the CAT scans themselves, they can be attached to an AI system that reads and diagnoses a pulmonary embolism instantly and can send a direct message to the providers with all of the patient characteristics, the clot location, and you can adjust the app itself to send you information that you want. So there's a lot of companies that are starting to develop these things. Most hospitals, especially larger hospitals who do stroke management, have a lot of this in place already. But for pulmonary embolism, it's a little bit lagging, but I think that's what we're going to start to see more commonly over the next several years, especially as more people are making this software. It'll be more accessible to everyone.
Okay, so now you've triggered my curiosity, because I've been hearing about artificial intelligence and its application to radiology. So you get a scan of the chest, right? And say in the case of pulmonary emboli, or even in the brain. Then what happens? So in other words, does the radiologist put it into an AI program, or do you do that on your phone? How do you come up with that?
So it's actually automatically linked to an app. So as soon as the scan is done, it's read by this AI system. And for example, I could choose if I wanted to be notified for every pulmonary embolism or only ones where the patient needs oxygen, or their heart rate is really fast, or they have certain blood tests that are positive. So you can kind of narrow it down to whichever type of patient and the degree of illness that you want. But it's basically, it's tied up to the CAT scan machine itself. And as soon as it's run, you're notified with the information.
So it eliminates the radiologist in this case?
Not necessarily, because the radiologist can also be part of the team that gets notified, and they will still review everything. But what it does is allows the providers who are managing, for example, a pulmonary embolism or stroke, to be notified immediately and not have to wait for the read of the CAT scan and then the other provider to look at it. So it speeds things up a little bit.
Well, I've got to tell you that I think you've hit a new high in information that we didn't know about, and I certainly didn't know about with that, Evan, that's for sure. It sounds like radiologists are going to be becoming like performers who have their music stolen by AI, but I think that we'll leave that to the future. I just want to take time to thank you. Thank you for coming on today, and thank you for informing us about this exciting concept with the PERT program available at St. Francis. And again, for our listeners, if you wish to contact Dr. Nadler or his office to be seen, it's 860-714-4055. Evan, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you, Dr. Alessi. I appreciate you having me and allowing me to talk about something I love and I'm passionate about. And I think we have a great team at St. Francis, and I would love to help anyone out who has questions or, you know, is in need of help in the office. Feel free to call me. I'll help with any sort of questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you again. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and we want to wrap things up today. As always, want to thank my guest, Dr. Evan Nadler, but I also want to thank our studio producer, Kevin Kors, who's been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we are going to be chatting with Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford from the Ratchford Eye Center, and we're going to be talking about vision and sunlight. And the damage it may be doing to eyes and possibly sunglasses. What's the best way to go? Also, if you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast and just download that wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to take this time to welcome and thank all mothers. Tomorrow is Mother's Day, so please take time to thank your mother and your other loved ones in your family, and spend time with your family. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Ratchford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.